And a lot of people don't really know about community psychology because it's one of the newer fields of the psychology field. And what makes community psychology different from what I thought I wanted to pursue, which was clinical psychology, is that community psychology looks at systems and how they impact people. So we don't just operate in one silo, right? So like, if we think about the example I like to give folks is, if there's a young person that's not doing well in school, the traditional model was, oh, what kind of deficit is the child have, whether it's an intellectual or behavioral, that's impacting their behavior, their performance in school? Versus a community psychology lens is just looking at the looking at systems and how they impact that child.
What's up, family? Welcome back to another episode of Why Y'all Working. I am your co-host, Michael Ogusanya.
I'm Alair J.
And we have an exciting episode here today. I'm sure you guys are wondering, like, when are y'all interviewing Obama? When's Joe Biden coming through? We've been on an interview streak, interviewing a number of amazing guests. And this guest here is no short of amazing. Someone that really cares about the social impact and social entrepreneurship side, with a clear established track record of leading people and leading change. We have Erica Myers, CEO and founder of Fosterpreneur, director within the Venture for America space. Please say what's up to the family.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here. And thanks for that amazing introduction. I had a second, I'm like, oh, he's talking about me. So grateful to be here.
For sure. Grateful to have you here. And we got to start with the first question, just going right off, is why do you work, Erica?
Yeah, I work for a variety of reasons. Like, I feel fortunate because most of my career, my work has been very like social impact focused. So like, my work gives me a lot of purpose. And having worked in Baltimore, DC, Miami, and particularly working in youth development, it's a huge part of who I am, and just allows me to tap into my zone of genius and my strength zone. And then also too, like, within our capitalist society, we gotta work, we gotta pay bills, and I need money. So I've been fortunate to be able to use my job to help me pay my bills, but also to, like, a big part of like the work that I do is driven by just purpose work.
And we're gonna go get deep into, you know, your history. Owings Mills native. I don't want to say too much, but I'm in Owings Mills as well. So if they find me, they'll find you. You found your way to the illustrious Spelman College in Atlanta, and then getting your master's as well in the University of Miami. I mean, you've been able to move along the East Coast and, I mean, succeed at that. So when you talk about why you work, there's a bit of survival, like you said, a bit of like getting to the next day. But it's clear that purpose and like passion has been like interwoven with your career. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't imagine doing the work that I do and not having passion and purpose behind it.
Absolutely.
And sorry, Michael, just really wanted to touch on something real quick. We're talking about passion and purpose, but when did you really find that in your journey, right? We want to make sure that, you know, we keep the audience engaged in terms of, you know, some of our audience members are people in college and kind of growing up and kind of developing in their career. So we also want to give them a kind of a perspective of, you know, from your lens, right? Like, how did that happen for you? When did you discover your passion and purpose there?
Alair, I'm so glad you asked me that, because I feel really fortunate because I had an amazing support system. I think back to how my parents raised me, and part of my upbringing was being exposed to a lot of different things. So like, I tried different sports. I was involved in the arts. Like, my mom was a huge proponent of allowing me to tap into the things that really gave, like, that she could see I was really passionate about. So when I think about the purpose part of it, starting from age, like, middle school, like around 12, 13, I knew that I wanted to be a clinical child psychologist for a while. I knew I wanted to work with children, and I knew like psychology was fascinating to me. So even in the midst of like being 13 and not having a full grasp of what that meant, I knew that I was going to do work tied to that. So that led me to be a psychology major. I majored in psychology at Spelman. And I was able to dive into research, and just part of that was looking at community psychology, but also doing child development research as well. So just some of those experiences really helped get me to where I am today. And then fast forward, I worked at, right after I graduated from college, and actually I just celebrated 15 years. It's crazy. It's been 15 years since I've graduated. I had a teaching fellowship at a charter school in DC. I worked with third and fourth graders. And I really loved working with children. Classroom wasn't for me. And I knew that psychology was still a big part of what I was going to go back into. And, did research on different graduate programs, particularly some masters, a few PhDs, and University of Miami had a community and social change program, which was based in the foundations of community psychology. And a lot of people don't really know about community psychology because it's one of the newer fields of the psychology field. And what makes community psychology different from what I thought I wanted to pursue, which was clinical psychology, is that community psychology looks at systems and how they impact people. So we don't just operate in one silo, right? So like, if we think about the example I like to give folks is, if there's a young person that's not doing well in school, the traditional model was, oh, what kind of deficit is the child have, whether it's an intellectual or behavioral, that's impacting their behavior, their performance in school? Versus a community psychology lens is just looking at systems and how they impact that child. So for example, does the child feel safe at school? Does it feel like within the classroom environment? Does the child feel safe within their community? Does the child feel safe at home? Does the child feel safe like in all these other systems that they interact with? Not saying that there isn't anything wrong or there isn't something that can't be addressed in the individual, but I mean, we're all in a layer. I think you're in Baltimore, so please correct me if you're not in the Baltimore area.
No, you're good. Yeah, I'm in the area.
Okay, so we're all in the Baltimore ecosystem, right? And people like to say things about our city and where we're from, and we can look at certain neighborhoods and we can see the impact of the systemic issues at play, right? So community psychologies look at that from multiple systems, from the micro to the macro. Fast forward, I was really curious about that, and that led me to apply for my master's degree. I'm in community psychology at University of Miami, and I wanted to live in Miami anyway, so it was a win-win for me. And that's what really was the catalyst for me to get involved in really like the purpose work. Because in Miami, that's where I really, really found the work that was my purpose work tied to Fosterpreneur, which I know we'll get to in a moment. So I know it was a long-winded way of kind of answering that question, but long story short, the exposure I had growing up, but also my college experience, my graduate school experience that led me to that passion and purpose work.
I appreciate you mentioning that, and that your mom and family were a big part of your developmental growth and kind of pushing you towards what your passions and goals were. Because I think that a lot of people may or may not have that. So it's also important to note that for you, that was a big proponent of your growth and how that helped you kind of keep going in that essence. But I also want to, you know, kind of touch on, you know, some dark moments that may not have been the greatest in that journey, right? I know that everybody kind of goes through some kind of points of, you know, maybe this isn't for me, right? Did you ever have those moments, and how did you kind of work your way out of them? You know, just want to give the people perspectives.
Great questions. Let me tell you, like, for the most part, I believe that sometimes your darkest moments can be your greatest moments. And that's been the case for me throughout my life. So I mentioned that I lived in Miami for 3 years. And as I was getting to my third year, I knew that I wanted to come back to the DC area. I wanted to pursue policy work. I had been working in community-based organizations that supported foster care youth, which was a huge part of just who I am and like what I wanted to, the ways I wanted to contribute, because I saw a lot of challenges there that I wanted to help address. And I thought policy was the way to do that, because I took a few policy related classes in graduate school. And I'm like, oh, what better place to do that than go back to DC? My parents are divorced. So my dad lives right outside of DC in Hyattsville. My mom's in Owings Mills. So at the time I was like, okay, one of my best friends from college was a White House intern. This is 2014. And she was like, Erica, if you get in, then it's going to open up your network to being able to go into policy. You'll be able to make the impact you want to do. And I'm like, all right, bet I'm going to do this. And I pretty much, when I put my mind in something, I'm going to do it. So made the efforts to do it, got support on my personal statement, prepared for the interviews. And because I had someone who was already had gone through the process, I knew what to do. So I made it to the semifinalist round. And I had three interviews before I got to the semifinalist round. So I was really feeling myself. Like, I'm not even gonna lie. I was really feeling myself. I resigned from my job in Miami, already started finding a subletter. And then actually, I think if I remember correctly, it may have been the day that I resigned from my job in Miami, I found out that I was on the waiting list. And I was like, how is this going to, like, oh, this must be a mistake. This is not going to happen. But I'm like, oh, I've made it this far. It's super competitive. It's all going to work out. Mom and dad, like, they'll be supportive. So I was operating as if it was going to happen. Then as it got close to, like, me moving home, I didn't tell my mom that I was on the waiting list. I'm like, oh, this is going to work out. And then I get home and she's like, when are you going to start? And I was like, oh, so what happened was I was on the waiting list. So she's like, you resigned from your job, gave up everything, and you ain't got no job. Like, you don't have a backup plan. Like, I didn't raise you like this. Fast forward, I got rejected. I had no plan B. I had very little savings, didn't have a network here at all. And I was like, man, I went through all these hoops. Like, how did this happen? Like, it was really devastating to me because I was telling everybody, like, I'm a White House intern, even when it didn't happen yet, because I was just operating on faith in that way. So when I ultimately got rejected, I was really crushed. And I had a really good conversation with my close friends. And I remember crying on the phone to her. I was like, I made this, did all of this. And then I was like, wait, what if I combine entrepreneurship and help foster care youth in this way? So I say that just to say, like, I had this plan in my head of what it was going to be like. Like, I was going to go the policy route, gave up everything, had no job, had no backup plan. Yes, I had family, so, like, I could stay here, but, like, I didn't have a job. I didn't have a way to support myself aside from living at home. And even in the midst of that embarrassment and me feeling like I had egg on my face and, like, doing all these things, if it weren't for that rejection, I don't think that would have led me to Fosterpreneur. So there was a really low moment at that time, but it really set me up for being even better aligned with the purpose work.
No, okay. That's definitely a strong point that you make, and I appreciate you sharing your journey and in that progress of, like, just being able to pivot at your worst moment, right? Like, just thinking that shit hit the fan, you're like, oh, damn, like, I was a shoo-in, right? That's what you were thinking. Like,
yeah.
There was no way they could pick me. And then you were on the waiting list, and you were still like, man, I got this. There's no way. Which is crazy, to be honest. But, like,
no, it was. But I was feeling myself. I was like, oh, nobody, like, I'm here. Like, nobody's going to mess with me. Oh, I'm telling you, like, the naivete of youthness sometimes is it can really get the best of you, but it's also great at the same time.
And Michael,
I gotta share a story just like on that same energy. I'm sure, as you know, like Mindstand, the company I co-founded, were able to go through the Techstars Equitech program, but it was not that simple, I will say. We, you know, as soon as Equitech Tuesday started becoming a thing, we were there. Like, when no one was there, we were there. When it was four people were there, we were there. Or I say we, it was me. I was still finding my way to make my way all the way out to, was it Omo Casino originally? And
at Omo Casino. Yes.
We got into another accelerator, definitely a local one. I mean, another one that's almost like a competitor, you know, where you're getting 150K, you're competing. We chose not to go into that program. I mean, we got in, but we're like, yo, like you said, you know, the idea of success, the idea of being in a place that sounds the right opportunity for you just can, like, outweigh any other decision. So we're like, nope, we're not going to take it. We actually sent them like a long paragraph about why we thought their investment thesis or how they invested wasn't right. Boy, I hope I didn't burn that bridge. Time will tell. I moved. We were like, our lease was up in our like house we were staying in together, the four of us. And I moved to downtown Baltimore, 6 minutes from St. Paul Street. So that's the office, or at least that area near Station North. We still haven't gotten in yet. I'm going to all the Equitechs. It's a lot easier for me now. And we apply for the program. You know, I'm nudging people, hint, hint. And they tell us we didn't get in. I, like, picked everything up. I moved 6 minutes away from a program that I was no longer going to be in. Boy, I was pissed. But by utilizing, it's getting me heated just thinking about it, man.
It definitely be like that sometimes, Michael.
I understand the feeling. You know, it's like, how dare you? What? Do you see what I've done?
It wasn't until we reached out to like other accelerators that we were in, utilizing kind of, like you said, that community aspect of a program that was its first time being based in Baltimore, we were able to at least put a feeler out for them to understand that, hey, this company is, you know, kind of the company that you're thinking of when you think of the Equisec mission, when you think of landing strong in Baltimore. They ended up at the time, the managing director ended up coming to my apartment. They like call me or text me. I don't even know. Maybe I put my phone number in the application, but they text me saying, hey, do you want to meet up? I'd let them know, come to my apartment. They come there, we sit in the lobby, and they say, hey, we think that you guys can be a big part of this. We go through like the stages, the interviews, and we get in like a month later. So, boy, I was so annoyed because the apartment, it was cool, but I mean, hey, I could have went somewhere else. But opportunity, like you said, can be the driving force behind making some sometimes reckless decisions.
Yeah, and I love that you shared how like how we, you can definitely relate to the fact of like you made all these preparations and it just seemed like it was super aligned, and then it's like, wait, what? But it positioned you to be where you needed to be, you know, like that hindsight is 2020, but when you're going through it at the time, it does not feel good.
Yeah. And it can leave you with some scars, but right. At the end of the day, you just got to keep pushing. And I want to know from you, like, as you like grow Frostrepreneur and in the work that you do, do you still find yourself kind of being kind of almost risk averse as a result of what you experienced, or a bit more like risk tolerant to what could be?
You know, let me tell you, I would say that I'm a little bit more risk averse in the sense of, I am not someone that advocates unless you have a lot of financial support, whether that's like family that can help you out or you have a supportive partner, spouse, whoever. I'm not a fan of going all in. And when I say going all in, like if you don't have a system, a really clear system in place, and then going all in on your business. And I feel like for a long time in the entrepreneur space, it's like, oh, if you're not fully committed to your business or your social innovation, if you don't go all in. But the truth of the matter is, if you go all in, you can sometimes bounce. It can be ugly. And I feel like I'm not someone who believes in struggling for struggle's sake. And I think that some people kind of wear that as a badge of honor. But I really think about Maslow's hierarchy in the sense of, if you don't have your basic needs met or you're struggling to take care of yourself at that foundational level, you can't give all that energy to your social impact, your business. I mean, there are examples of people who have done that, right? But I think about it from the lens of being part of the global majority, but also being part of an underrepresented group in the US and just what our current system is. And I think it's important to be very calculated with your risk taking. Not to dismiss anybody who's gone all in and it's worked out really well, but for myself, I'm glad my story is my story. But if I had a little bit more insight, I would have made sure that I was proactive with like a part-time opportunity and other things going into it, instead of just being like, oh, it's all gonna work out, because debt collectors don't take like stop stories like that. You know what I mean? Like, you still have to be able to take care of yourself. But I am someone who believes in taking those calculated risks. So like, whether it's applying to a program and it looks like you may not fit all the credentials, still do that. Not waiting to like everything's perfect. So I am different in that way, but not the whole let's take the net and hope, like let's leap and hope the net appears, and then I'm stressed because of financial challenge. I don't like that feeling.
I mean, it's clear like you come off well learned, you come off well experienced and wise. Were there books that, or like knowledge sources, mentorship groups that you utilized, or was it always, has it been like this tale of trial and error?
definitely, I'm a huge fan of personal development. So part of that has been reading leadership books, like John Maxwell is someone that I'm a huge fan of. I've listened, so I have like a podcast rotation right now. So I'm a huge fan of How I Built This. So I listen to Guy Russ's podcast. I also am a fan of the Jordan Harbinger Show, just to be more well-rounded about just different global issues. I also listen to Eric Thomas. I'm a huge fan of Eric Thomas and what he's done with his enterprises. And then also, I will say in recent years, one book that has completely changed my life is Rachel Rogers' We Should All Be Millionaires. And I actually really re-listened to some of her podcast episodes recently. And one of the podcast episodes that really stuck in my mind that I've been reminding myself every day is that abundance is our birthright. So the reason why I bring up Rachel Rogers is because I never in like the personal development space, the entrepreneur space, felt like I found somebody who spoke to me in the ways that like made sense to me as just a Black woman in the US who's just working on building, like in the fact of like, we need money in order to like, it's not bad wanting to be wealthy. It's not bad any of these things. And I feel like for myself, being raised in African Methodist Episcopal Church and like going to church every Sunday, there was this constant message of like, if you attain wealth of a certain status, that meant that you were immoral or you did anything wrong. And like, I've done a lot of conditioning to be like, hey, in order for me to help serve the people that I want to serve, but also live the life that I want to live and support my family and like other friends' endeavors, I need money. And that's not a bad thing. Like, and not allowing the narratives of the media of, you know, like, we're about to enter in the presidential election. You know, people have ideas about Donald Trump and other things, right? Like not allowing what we see or like limited ideas of what wealth looks like or what you're supposed to act like, when there are plethora examples of wealthy individuals who are generous, who are kind, who are living fulfilling lives and giving back in meaningful ways. So like Rachel Rogers, like articulated things that I was like, I feel like this exists. And like, I'm like a huge fangirl of her work because it's really comforting to have somebody where it's like, okay, not only do you have a seven-figure business, but you speak to the historical lens of why we need to do this, but also acknowledging the social stuff, but how love making money and like doing good with it, like that's how what I aspire to be.
Yeah, and I think with business, it's important to note that like you can have your cake and eat it too, but yeah. It depends on how you do that is whether or not people are going to make a decision on or actually have an opinion on whether or not that is actually good or bad, right? Like if you decide to be in a defense contracting world and you know you work with people who don't necessarily want their work going to overseas wars and such like that, like you're in the wrong business for what you're trying to do. But if you're giving back and doing all these things, you could say potentially that you're offsetting the bad that you're doing versus the good. I don't know. And, you know, but like there's also different points at which where I think that for you and other women like you specifically, like coming from that lens, having that historical perspective of like, okay, here's the reason why we should be involved in business and making wealth. And at least if you're not wealthy, understanding, having a financially literate mind and opening up others to that possibility of doing more and having more so that way they can be free from whatever system that they're born into, I think is an incredibly important point to kind of note and bring up, even from a religious perspective as well, because I find that very uncanny that, you know, from a lot of religious institutions will be like, hey, don't, if you have too much money, you need to give that to the church. But like at the end of the day, the church is also a business. So
exactly.
I mean, at the end of, they know that there's money to be had in that. And I think that for some reason, we all keep that information and that financial knowledge hidden. For what reason, I don't know yet, but maybe we'll never know. But I do want to do our part in making sure that other people have access to this information, and we're doing that here by having you on the show and talking about it. So definitely appreciate you sharing. Oh, Michael, I know that you cut out a little bit there too. Are you okay?
I know the bat, like I left my charger somewhere. So USB-C cables are like charging up my whole setup right now, but gotcha. I'm still here. If you can okay. Still hear me.
Yeah, still hear you. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, video record, you know, it'll be a little delay. So So don't worry if I look like a robot. I do want to understand, and it's just to let you know, to preface, we often like understand people's upbringing, whether cultural background and everything. What was it like? Were your parents originally from Maryland in Owings Mills? Did they come to America? You spoke a bit about it, but I'd love to understand your cultural background and how that influences you today.
Yeah, so I am a second generation college student. So my mom is born and raised in Baltimore. My dad was born in Tampa and came to DC at the age of 16. And when it comes to my family history, like my great grandmother was from the Bahamas, and I am on my mom's side, proud descendant of enslaved Africans. And one of the things that I really am grateful for is like my parents are boomers, and they remember going into stores where my mom remembers coming to downtown Baltimore and not being able to try on shoes and clothes, right? Like, and I don't view my mom as old, but like I have that, like I have some of those stories. And one of the things that I really commend with my dad is a pharmacist, and he was one of 11, and all of his siblings were all really successful. Like they all pretty much left Tampa and like created their own legacies in different cities and such. And one of the things I keep in mind, particularly like my dad, is super resilient. He failed the pharmacy test like 5 times, but like didn't give up each time. It was like, I know that I want better for myself than like the poverty I was born into in Tampa, and I'm gonna do this. So when I think about like sometimes when I've been close to giving up on certain things, I'm like, my dad failed a major exam 5 times before getting his license to practice pharmacy. So like, that's something that I keep in the back of my mind a lot. And then even my mom was the first in her family that attended college. So that was like a really big deal. And then even the investments on my parents made in me educationally, like I was able to attend private school my entire life. And I don't believe there's any perfect school fit for like any child, but it did afford me certain opportunities that I may not have had if there were other choices that were made. So when I think about who I am and just the sacrifices and the things that my parents went through that I, and life experiences they had that I didn't even have to think about having, like, I feel really blessed I've had a very great childhood.
Appreciate you saying that. And with that being said, we are going to take a slight break and come back for our second segment, getting into Erica's more recent endeavors, particularly around her career, that development there, and then maybe some future possibilities around what's going on, what's happening, and what we can get into and what we can learn from. So appreciate you, Erica, for sharing. Love to get into a little bit more when we come back from the break. So thanks, everyone. It's been Why Y'all Working. I'm your host.